Thank you for both those very wonderful, wonderful music today. Thank you. Shortly after, I got my book about Rick Mastin out. I got a note from a church in Carmel, California, which is Rick's lifelong hometown, asked if they could purchase some copies to sell in their bookstore. They also said they were a see to it that it got a review in one of their church's publications. But whenever you get a book out, something like that, it's just fine. So I said, certainly be glad to provide you with anything I can. It all happened because these were very good friends of mine and were also friends of Rick's before he passed away. And they were very strongly involved in this Carmel church. Now, I'm not referring to the UU Church of Monterey and Carmel, which hosted a wonderful book launch service for Rick and me nearly 2 years ago, a few months before Rick passed away. Now, this other church, as it were, calls itself the Church of Religious Science. I gotta say, the name was what intrigued me. Church of Religious Science. It's not to be confused, should not be confused with either Scientology or Christian Science. It actually has a rather kind of a New Age flavor to it, holding that God is not a person or a being of any kind, but rather a universal presence or power that is also present in human beings. A lot of its tenets and principles like this would be ones that I would think that probably a number of you use, including in some instances myself, would be simpatico with. But it has not come out of the same historical path of tradition as we do. It is more of an offshoot of some of the more esoteric new thought movements that sprang up in the United States throughout the 19th century. But like I said, I was taken by the name of a congregation that calls itself the Church of Religious Science. And I recall the name as I set out to prepare this sermon, since there's a genre of thought and writing getting a fair amount of attention right now, which would hold that the terms religion and science do not rightfully belong in the same sentence, much less in the name of a religious organization. I've referred to this genre in the past using a phrase I call the atheist fight back. Principal figures in this movement are a triumvirate of Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, and Sam Brown. I've had my say about these gentlemen, especially Dr. Dawkins and his book, The God Delusion and Other Sermons, so I'm not going to deal with them at any length today. But while I agree with much of their critiques of religion, both past and present, and I agree as well with many of the critiques of ways of believing in God, I also find in much of their writing a kind of a smugness and an arrogance that rivals, if not surpasses, anything I witnessed or was a part of in the near Christian fundamentalism in which I was raised. And the best example of what I mean here is in Christopher Hitchens' book. He wrote a book called God Is Not Great, in which he suggests that those enlightened persons like himself, of course, who have freed themselves from the shackles of any and all forms of religion and any and all kinds of belief in God, he believes that such people as these should be referred to as brights. The brights. The designation presumably is to distinguish them, these brights as they wish to be called, from all of those unenlightened dim bulbs who are still mindlessly clinging to any form of religion any kind of belief in God. We call ourselves brights to distinguish ourselves from all those not quite so enlightened folks. And the presumption behind this presumption is that one cannot be a rational-minded human being and a person of faith of any kind simultaneously. Kind of like, the law of physics that says two physical objects can't occupy the same space at the same time. Well, I'd say when it comes to the laws of physics, that's a perfectly sound and rational an entirely self-evident principle. I can't put something else where this book is here. But I don't believe that that idea can be transposed lock, stock, and barrel to matters of faith and belief. And that's the thread I want to pursue for a little bit of the, not for some of the rest of this sermon. And I guess if I'm going to touch on the topic of faith and rationality, perhaps the most rational thing to do at the beginning would be to roll out a definition of rational. So we can do that using my trusty old Random House Webster's College Dictionary, which has helped me through numerous New York Times crossword puzzles over the years, and it is straightforward enough. Rational in this tome simply means based on reason, as in a rational decision, or exercising reason as a rational negotiator. using this definition, most, if not all of us in this room, will consider ourselves rational persons. But I'm going to pose a question for you. It's going to call for some honest self-inventory. So honest, in fact, that I'm not going to ask, as I put it out here, for a show of hands, as it might create some issues in your relationships with those who are closest to you. Now that I got your attention, here's the question. For those of you who are in a marriage or some other ongoing and committed partnered relationship, was falling in love with the partner you are with now an entirely rational act or choice on your part? Maybe you can see why I'm not asking for a show of hands. Figure those of you who are partnered anyways, you can have this conversation by yourself or with each other at some other point. But what I'm saying is that human attraction, some of which lead to committed relationships, usually occur on the basis of something other than the use of our purely rational faculties. I want you to just file that. I'm going to come back to this point a little bit later. I am going to say, though, before continuing that thread, that one place where I do agree with the triumvirate I already cited of Dawkins, Hitchings, and Brown, not a law firm, is their rejection of the notion that supernatural explanations can be invoked in trying to explain natural phenomena. Or to put it more simply, I agree that we don't need God to explain how stuff works. How stuff works, mind you. While we human beings on this planet have hardly unlocked all the secrets or explanations as to how our universe operates and how life on this planet operates, we pursue these matters using the strength of our human reason as far as we can push it and keep pushing it. We live in a scientific age. And I am quite willing to do a variation on some words of Jesus, to render unto science and to reason and to rationality all that rightly belongs there. I'm perfectly content, for example, to rely upon the theory or the principle of evolution, knowing it's still a work in progress, to explain why I have the physical makeup that I have and the human characteristics that I have, why my body works the way it does, and beyond that, how we've come to have all the life forms that now exist on our earthly home here. I do not look for, I feel no need for, any faith-based, in a supernatural sense I mean, any faith-based explanations for any of that. When it comes to basically just understanding data, that is to say, I would say the only faith that's called for is faith in the process of reason and rational inquiry that gives us the answers we have, even as we know those answers are incomplete. As a sidebar issue here, I would point out that the ways in which we now treat or immunize against any number of infectious diseases, many of which were fatal at other times in human history, draw upon the theory of evolution. It is evolutionary theory that allows medical researchers to better understand how germs and viruses operate in the human organism, which in turn allows for these diseases and germs and viruses to be treated and hopefully even prevented. We know that. But it also makes me wonder, if those persons whose faith compels them to reject the theory of evolution, are they willing to be consistent enough in their faith to reject any form of medicine based on that theory? The most rational, quote-unquote, conclusion, I would think, for a strict creationist, would be to reject any kind of medical intervention that's based on a theory that they reject. Why would one want to be treated on the basis of a false theory, after all? But we can move on. And the point I would move on to now is to suggest that when it comes to how we actually live our lives and how we make the kinds of choices that we make as to how we will live our lives, we are always dealing, consciously or not, with an interplay between faith and reason. It may or may not be faith in God. It can be. It may not necessarily be faith in God, however conceived. But it is faith, nonetheless. And the story that each one of us is telling with each of our lives, then, is a story shaped by faith and reason. And it was just this past week, earlier in this week, that I listened to an amazing portion of one person's life story that I think bears this point out. The person telling the story was Liz Walker. She's a very dynamic, very well-spoken African-American woman. If you're one who pays or has paid in the past any attention to local newscasts, you'll recognize the name. She was a longtime broadcaster and commentator for Boston's WBZ-TV News. It wasn't until I saw her and was actually introduced to her that I realized how tall she was. You know, all I'd ever seen her before then was just sitting behind a desk broadcasting news. She's about 6'1". And that was just quite an experience, just looking up to say, it's a pleasure to meet you, Ms. Walker. Well, she was, for 32 years, a television journalist. She spent 20 of those years as the anchorwoman at WBZ-TV. And then, I believe she was about in her early to mid-50s, she decided it was time for her life to go in another direction. She enrolled in the Harvard Divinity School, got her Master of Divinity degree, became an ordained minister in the African Methodist Episcopal Church, and joined the ministerial staff of the Bethel AME Church in Jamaica Plain in Boston. And not just Boston, part of the ministry she is engaged in right now involves making frequent trips to, because she's helping to run, a school for girls in the Sudan in Africa, which is a rather dangerous undertaking right now, given that that country is being governed, if you can call it that, by a fundamentalist Islamic government that frowns upon, severely frowns upon, women being too educated, as it were. And in fact, it was a fact-finding trip that Ms. Walker took to the Sudan in 2001 with her journalist hat on that played a significant role in the turn her life has taken right now. That's a whole other story in and of itself. And she still keeps a hand in broadcasting with her Sunday with Liz program, which runs on Channel 4. Well, I heard Ms. Walker, now Reverend Walker, tell at least part of her story in an entirely secular setting. I was in the Lowell Repertory Theater, Lowell Auditorium, last Tuesday night at an event sponsored by the Greater Lowell Community Foundation to celebrate some of the outreach work that that organization does. But I can tell you, the setting really didn't matter. Even though it was not an official sermon, that woman can really preach. About 20 minutes worth of stuff that would just knock your socks off. And I listened as I heard to her, not just to what she had to say about what's happening in her life right now, but I was tuning in as well to the passion in her voice as she spoke of the importance of heeding the call to service to a greater cause and to a greater calling beyond one's own life. Whatever the nature of that cause, whatever that calling may be. And as I listened to her, I thought about, well, what is it that drives a decision like the one that she has made? Like I said, she was speaking in a secular setting. She went very light on God talk, any kind of religious language, while not completely shunning it, though. But it was clear, as I listened to her, that the now Reverend Liz Walker was and is being called and driven and directed by certain forces, both within her and beyond her, which, while hardly irrational or unreasonable, go a step beyond the rational and the reasonable. She would say it wasn't just that she decided to take her life in a new direction, but in some larger sense, it was also being decided for her. And so among the many things I took from listening to Reverend Walker on that evening was yet another example, and a particularly stirring example, of what it means to be both a person of reason and a person of faith. I'm sure the choice she made to give up her anchor post at WBC and go to theological school and pursue the kind of ministerial career that she now has, there's no way that could not have called for a lot of very reason and rational-minded thinking. You know, can I afford to do this? How much time will it take? Given the age I'm in right now, is this a good life kind of a move to make? Do I even know for sure where I'll be whenever I get to wherever it is that I want to go? I would imagine all those kinds of questions and more had to go through her mind as she considered and tried to react, reflect upon, respond to this call, as she called it. But beyond all those reasoned and necessary questions was an act of faith, drawing upon a message she had received from who knows where or from whom, about the direction her life needed to take. And this is why I say, I believe that the most life-changing and life-altering choices that we make are really acts of faith. They may not need to be, they don't need to be as dramatic and completely turning around as the one that Ms. Walker made, but I think they are acts of faith. because I really wasn't trying to be cute or frivolous a few minutes ago. When I asked if the decision you made about who your life mate would be, for those of us who have one, when I asked if that was strictly a rational one, I don't mean to say that such decisions as these are, generally speaking, irrational or unreasonable, just that they go beyond the rational. My colleague and now my late friend in the UU ministry, Reverend Barr's church, actually coined a term for this phenomenon, which I've come to like. He called it the trans-rational, something that goes beyond the rational. It's another way of knowing. It's knowing about the meanings of our hearts as well as our minds. It's knowing about the lives we feel called to lead, even if we cannot identify a caller with a capital C. It's knowing about some of the deepest affirmations we hold that are not measurable and not quantifiable in only rational ways. That's not irrational. I kind of like that term, transrational, or maybe suprarational, above and beyond it. Consider, for example, our first Unitarian Universalist principle, which says we covenant to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. That's really a statement or an affirmation of faith. There's no rational way, in the scientific sense at any rate, to prove inherent worth and dignity. Instead, it is something that we choose to believe about people and about ourselves, even when the actual demonstrable evidence might run well to the contrary. And yet, it is this affirmation of faith that serves as the grounding for much of the social justice work that so many of us are engaged in. Again, as I say, it is not irrational to hold to such an affirmation, but it is one that takes us beyond the rational. So it is as a community of faith that we are called to act upon the principles that we have chosen to define us. To believe that justice, equity, and compassion in human relations is worth pursuing and worth investing some pieces of our lives in, to believe that is an act of faith, as is pursuing the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all, as is seeking ways to best and most responsibly live in the interdependent web of life that unfolds us all. Speaking personally, another affirmation for me as I pursue goals such as these is that I do so with a life that is part of some larger reality, part of some greater whole, whose fullness I cannot know, but in which I participate nonetheless. And I will close with this. One of the greatest affirmations of faith we can offer at times is believing that we have something here in this beloved community that is greater than the sum of our individual parts and that can sustain us in some of our most trying and painful moments. As we've noted earlier and at times in this service, in these past few days, we lost one of our most beloved members in a way that seems to defy any kind of reason. Of course, we can find out, we can know the means by which Marie lost her life. That does not tell us why in any greater sense. But this is one of those times when we have to reach for what it is we truly and most deeply know by whatever ways we know it. We know that in some of life's most devastating moments, we can still stand with and for one another. We know we can find ways to love and care about one another. We know that we cannot fix another person's or another family's loss. We can choose to believe, however, that love is stronger than death, and even the most painful loss can still strengthen those bonds of love. And this is the faith we are called to maintain at this time. For we are both persons of mind, and we are persons of spirit, and we are not whole people unless we have both, and unless we're acting on both. So let us hold one another in our minds and in our hearts and in our spirits in the days ahead.